Well, hey, we are doing a two-week series on the book of Esther. It's an Old Testament book, maybe not super well known. And when we decided to do this, I got to tell you, I had my reservations. Because to cover an entire book of the Bible in 2 weeks is tough. And I knew that I couldn't do it justice. And we really couldn't dig in to the meat of this story as well as I wish we could. And so I decided to take kind of a shortcut. The next couple of weeks, I found these amazing online videos that you have access to. They have them for all the books of the Bible, and they really are a good summary of these books. And so we're going to use snippets of some of these videos to get the content to you as quickly as I can, and then allow us to dig into the meat. So we're going to start by watching a short snippet that will set up kind of what the book is about. Here we go.
The Book of Esther, it's one of the more exciting and curious books in the Bible. The story is set over 100 years after the Babylonian exile of the Israelites from their land. And while some Jews did return to Jerusalem, remember Ezra and Nehemiah, many did not. And so the Book of Esther is about a Jewish community living in Susa, the capital city of the ancient Persian Empire. The main characters in this story are two Jews, Mordecai, and then his niece Esther. And then there's the king of Persia, who's something of a drunken pushover in this story. And then there's the Persian official Haman, the cunning villain. Now, this is a curious book in the Bible, mainly for the fact that God is never even mentioned, not once. Which might strike you as kind of odd. I mean, isn't the Bible about God? But this is a brilliant technique by the author, who's anonymous, by the way. It's an invitation to read this story looking for God's activity, and there are signs of it everywhere. The story is full of very odd, quote, coincidences and ironic reversals, and it all forces you to see God's purpose at work, but behind the scenes.
So that's where we're going to stop and dig back into the story. And I want to talk about this idea that God is absent from the book of Esther, and the video is true. God is not mentioned. It never says God. It never says Lord. It never says Yahweh. It never says any of it. In fact, there really aren't even references to religious activity. There's no reference to the Bible. There's no reference to prayer. It's like they don't know who God is. And yet, I completely disagree with that statement. I think that God is in the book, not named, but active, but kind of behind the scenes. And that means that we're going to have to look for what's not obvious. We're going to have to look for what is there but maybe is hard to see. And it's going to require us to use different kinds of thinking than we typically do in Scripture, where everything is often handed to us on a silver platter. Esther is not that way. Esther is going to require some work. We're going to have to look for God who is present but unseen. And I want to give you a few examples of what I'm talking about because we know what this is. We know what it is to have something that is there but unseen. So I took a few pictures. The first one, actually, my friend took on a vacation recently. Tell me what's going on in this picture. It's the ocean. Yes, thank you, Isaac. What else besides the ocean? What is going on in that picture? It's really windy, right? And actually, you can even tell that it's often windy on that beach, right? That tree has literally grown in the direction that the wind tends to push it. And it was windy on the day that she took the picture, but we can tell that it's often windy. We can see the effects of the wind even though we can't see the wind. And because this is a picture, you can't even feel the wind. And yet most of you immediately knew what was going on in this picture. You are seeing the effects of something that you cannot see. Or how about this picture? Some of you, I hope most of you, can see that on the right side of that bubble, there's the color green and the color purple. Some of you are thinking to yourself, what? What? You don't see it? Left side for you, sorry. Yeah. On the other side is just grays. This is an actual test that they use to determine if someone has a specific type of color blindness. Now, some people cannot see those colors, and when they are given a test like this, they realize, maybe for the first time in their whole life, that they are colorblind. Now, there are varieties of color blindness, but some people don't know that they are colorblind until they take this kind of a test. They always just thought they were really bad at getting dressed in the morning. Turns out they're colorblind, but you can't see it even though it's there. Those colors are there even if some people can't see it. Or how about this picture? A couple weeks ago, I showed a video of people playing basketball. They were passing the ball around. I told you to count how many passes there were. And some of you did a decent job of counting. Some of you not so great. And others of you noticed that there's a gorilla in the middle of this picture. But many of you did not notice that there was a gorilla in the video. Even though he was there the whole time, you just didn't see it. And in the same way, in the book of Esther, God is there and at work, even if we don't see it. Even if Esther didn't see it, God was at work. Jesus tells us in John chapter 5, "My Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working." So if God is always at work, that means God was at work in the book of Esther, was at work in the story, even if we can't see it. So what we need to do is learn to see it. And in order to do that, we need to learn more of the story. So we're going to do video part 2.
The book opens with the king of Persia throwing 2 elaborate banquet feasts that last a total of 187 days. And it's all for the grandiose purpose of displaying his greatness and splendor. On the last day of the banquet feast, he's really drunk, and he demands that his wife, Queen Vashti, appear at the party to show off her beauty. She refuses, and so in a drunken rage, the king deposes Vashti and makes the silly decree that all Persian men should now be the masters of their own homes. Then he holds a beauty pageant because he wants to find a new queen. This is like a really bad soap opera. But it's right here that we're introduced to Esther and Mordecai. Esther hides her Jewish identity and enters the beauty pageant and wins. And the king is so obsessed with Esther that he elevates her to become the new queen of Persia. Now, after this, and even more serendipitous, is the fact that Mordecai just happens to overhear 2 royal guards plotting to murder the king. And so he informs Esther, who in turn informs the king, and Mordecai gets credit for saving the king's life. Now, right here from the beginning, God's not mentioned anywhere, but this all seems providentially ordered. What is it that God's up to? You have to keep reading. We're next introduced to Haman, who's not actually a Persian. He's called an Agagite. He's a descendant of the ancient Canaanites. Remember 1 Samuel chapter 15. The king elevates Haman to the highest position in the kingdom, and he demands that everybody kneel before Haman.
Okay, we're going to stop there and dig back into the story. I want to summarize a few things that he mentioned. First of all, 187-day-long party. Like, that's serious, right? And secondly, I want to say a little shout-out to Queen Vashti, who gets overlooked in this story. Her husband, the king, who clearly is a drunken jerk, demands that she come and show her beauty to everyone, all of his buddies. A lot of commentators believe that the king wanted her to come unadorned, if that makes sense. And Vashti refuses. She is not going to show off for his buddies. She is not going to lower herself. She has a sense of self-esteem and self-worth and says no. And the deal is, you don't say no to the king. There are consequences. Now, it ends up being that she loses her title as queen. It could have been a lot worse for Vashti, and she knew that, and yet was still prideful enough to say, no, I will not do it. And in light of the Me Too movement that's going on in the world today, I feel like Vashti needs a little shout out for having some self-respect. I want to dig into the story, and we're going to look for places where we see the unseen. And I want to start in chapter 2. It says that Esther, when he's called by the king to come to this beauty pageant, Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Now, on the surface, this just seems smart. Don't tell them that you are part of this minority group that's not highly regarded. But on the other hand, it also identifies that she knows who she is. She knows her identity as a Jewish person. Now, the Jews were forcibly sent to Persia, and they could have easily adopted Persian culture, Persian religion, but they didn't. They kept their identity as Jewish people. And that identity is not just about genetics or race. That identity has a lot to do with their religious faith in the one true God. And so somehow, despite everything that has happened to Mordecai and to Esther, she has retained that sense of identity. She still is Jewish. And so we should recognize the fact that their actions during the course of this story are going to be from the perspective of a Jewish person who believes in the one true God. And when we see it through that lens, things start to make a little more sense. We also see very early on that even though she's an orphan and Mordecai is not her father, he's her uncle, she is well loved. We see that in verse 11. It says, every day he, Mordecai, walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. You see, she was sent to the palace. Mordecai cannot go in the palace, but he loves his niece. He wants to make sure she's okay. And so we see him constantly just kind of hanging out as close as he can get to her, checking on her on a regular basis. He's a good, loving uncle. We see that early on in the story. Now, there's an unexpected consequence here of the fact that Mordecai is a good, loving uncle. Because he's constantly hanging out near the palace, he happens to overhear a conversation that's happening within the palace walls. In verse 21, it says, during this time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. So this is all kind of circumstantial stuff, right? Mordecai happens to be in the right place to overhear this plot from people who really did have access to kill the king, and he saves the king's life. That's a coincidence. That's odd that he happens to be at the right place at the right time to save the king's life. And you would think that the fact that Esther and Mordecai saved the king's life would give them some, you know, credit or leverage in the kingdom. You would be wrong, though, because the king is not a very rational guy. He's often drunk and known to make bad decisions. But his worst decision of all is what's going to come next. We learn about a guy named Haman in chapter 3, and he's the bad guy. He's not good, okay? Just so you know, it's like really bad. When I say Haman, you should like feel things, bad things. Okay, chapter 3, verse 1. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the other royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, why do you disobey the king's command? Now this is an official command of the king. Again, you have to do what the king says. The king says, everybody bow down and worship Haman. And everyone does. Even the royal officials, these are important people, they all bow down, and whenever Haman's near, they bow and kneel in his presence, except Mordecai. Mordecai does not do it, refuses to do it. And they even ask him, why? Why are you disobeying the king's command? Here's the thing. Mordecai never answers this question. He never comes out and says, it's because I only bow to the one true God. Like, I wish he did, but he doesn't say it. So all we can do is judge him based on his actions, because his words don't give us much to go on. And his actions are very interesting. Why will he not bow to Haman? Because self-preservation would say that he should do it. Right? He doesn't want to die. None of us want to die. And so you would say he would do it for that reason. Plus, he's got a niece to care for. You would think that he would do it at least for her, so that she's not left totally alone in this world. He loves her. He clearly has shown that to us. Why will he not bow in order to at least stay alive for her sake? But he won't do it. He won't do it. And I believe that it tells us why if we keep going. It says, day after day, these are the royal officials, spoke to Mordecai, but he refused to comply. Therefore, they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. Now, it doesn't come out and say it as clearly as I wish it did. But at some point, when they asked him, why will you not bow? He said, I'm Jewish. He told them that that's who he was. His identity was bound into his actions. He would not bow because he was Jewish. And if that is who his identity is, then we can pretty clearly say it was tied in with his religious understanding that he would not bow to anyone except God. He is standing up for his faith. His actions define who he is. Now, this doesn't go well for Mordecai. In fact, it doesn't go well for the Jewish people. In verse 5, it says, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet, having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of only killing Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Now, this is either a massive overreaction on the part of Haman, or there's more going on here than meets the eye. Why would Haman decide to kill all the Jewish people in Persia when only one of them has done something to offend him? Only Mordecai refuses to bow. Everyone else, apparently including all the other Jews, are willing to bow. Mordecai will not. So why would he overreact in such a grandiose way? Why would he command genocide because of one man's insult? It doesn't make any sense. Unless we remember that Haman is a Canaanite. Canaan is the promised land that the Jews took. And when I say took, I mean battled the people who already lived there and kicked them out and took their land. It's possible that Haman knows his history, and he knows that the Jewish people came and took possession of his land, and he's angry with the Jewish people and uses this as an excuse to enact revenge on all the Jewish people. It's also possible that Haman is just a jerk. We don't really know, but it seems like a massive overreaction if it's just him being a jerk. Now let's fast forward a little bit. Haman decides to go through with this plan to kill all the Jews, all of them, who live in Persia. And he has the power from the king in order to make this happen. It says in verse 12 that on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all of Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. So this is like official stuff. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. Because kill and destroy wasn't enough. You have to annihilate too. Young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, on the month of Adar, and plunder their goods. A copy of the text and edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people. Now, I've wondered to myself, Haman has the power to command this, but why would the people follow through? Because what Haman does is send out letters all over the country and say, you are commanded by the order of the king to kill all the Jewish people. And he's not sending this necessarily to soldiers. He's sending this to people. I mean, imagine if you opened your mailbox and you got a letter from the government saying, you need to go do something similar to this. I'm really hoping that you wouldn't do it, okay? That your Christian morals would force you to not participate. And so why? Like, why would the Persian people do this? It doesn't seem like the Jewish people have done anything to them. Why would they follow through on this command? Well, there's two reasons. One, he's the king, and he says you have to do it. It's not optional. Second, he even adds a little bit of a sweetener to the deal. If you noticed, it said, not only should you annihilate them, but you can also plunder them, which means take everything they own. And so if you're in a hard financial spot, maybe that's what tips you over the edge. Either way, what I need you to know is, this is going to happen. The king has commanded it. It is going to happen. They even set a day that this is supposed to happen. Now, Mordecai and all the other Jewish people must be scared. They must be. And so what I'm going to do today is this. I'm going to end here. Next week, we'll get to the part where it gets better, and it does. But I want to end here today. I'm not going to end with some happy note. I'm not going to wrap it up in a little bow. In fact, what I want to do is what I think the author wants us to do, which is ask some really hard questions. Because this is not easy stuff. This is hard biblical content, and I think that the author wants us, I think God wants us to wrestle with these scriptures and ask some questions. And so that's where I want to end today, is with some hard questions about this story. First, where is God? Why is he not showing himself? Why is he behind the scenes? In every other book, God appears. In every other book, people talk to God, and often God speaks back. Where is God in this story? And the second question is he going to come to the rescue of his people? Because his people, who he has claimed and made covenants with, that he said were everlasting, his people are in danger. Now, I believe that Mordecai and the other Jewish people would have been at least familiar with some of the teachings of the Old Testament. They would have known some of the stories. They would have known the story of the Jewish people in slavery in Egypt and how God sent Moses to rescue them and parted the Red Sea so they would be safely across. They would have known those stories, and so they must be asking themselves, where is God, and is he going to come to our rescue? And that question must have haunted them at night every day as that day on the calendar got closer and closer and closer. They must have been wondering, where is God, and is he going to help us? Now, I don't just want to end with those questions. I want to turn it to you, because I think that's part of what we're supposed to do when we read the Bible. And I want to ask two very similar questions. Where is God in your life, and is he going to come to your rescue? Now, I know our situation is different than the one that's going on in the book of Esther. And yet, I bet some of you often wonder, where is God in my life? I don't see him. He doesn't speak when I want him to. I've prayed for miracles. They don't happen. Where is God? And I've asked those questions. And I bet all of us, late at night, have wondered that. Where is God? I believe in God. I'm trying to be a faithful follower of Christ. Where is God? Why don't I see him? Why doesn't he speak to me? And then we've also sometimes asked the second question. Is he going to come to my rescue? Because most of us have been through some hard stuff or are going through some hard stuff. And there have been times where we wanted God to show up. We wanted God to help us. We wanted a miracle and wondered, why isn't it happening? Where is God? Why isn't he coming to my rescue? And I'm not saying that he's going to send in chariots or whatever else, like just something. Help. Hope. Where is God, and is he going to come to my rescue? And I'll admit to you guys, because some of you know that I'm in a point of transition in my life where I've stepped out in faith, and I haven't gotten quick answers sometimes. And there's been nights where I couldn't sleep, and I was in prayer, and I was asking these questions. Where's God? I'm trying to put my trust in God. Where is he? Is he going to show up? Is he going to help me? Is he going to help my family? Thank you, Isaac. And it's hard. And so I'm with you. If you've ever asked these questions on your knees at 2 in the morning, so have I. And there's no easy answers. And so we just have to be faithful to do what we know is right. Just like Mordecai did, to do the right thing at the right time, even if we don't know how the end is going to work out. We have to hang on to our identity, even in the midst of difficult circumstances, like Esther and Mordecai. And we will see in the second half of the story that it pays off, that their faith in God pays off, that God does come to the rescue again, kind of behind the scenes. And I do believe the words of Jesus, that God is working. Sometimes we just don't see it. I have good news for you, that you're in good company. Even Jesus, on the last night of his life, gathered with his disciples. They went to a park. And Jesus was struggling emotionally and wondering, where is God? He even prayed over and over, and he asked God, if there's another way besides my death, if there's another way, take this cup from me. You can see in that moment the fear in Jesus. You can see in that moment even the doubt of Jesus, because he was human, even though he was divine. And so if you're ever in that situation, you're in good company to wonder, where is God? And is he going to come to my rescue? Jesus in that night, though, made the decision that he was part of God's rescue plan for us. And so he decided to lay down his life on our behalf. And so he gathered that same day with his disciples, and he symbolically explained what he was willing to do for us. He took bread. He said, "This is my body, broken for you. Take and eat in remembrance of me." And then he took a cup. He said, "This is my blood, which I will willingly pour out on your behalf. Take and drink." And we remember his sacrifice as we gather at this table. And I want to be clear that this is a table that is for you. You may have fear, you may have doubt, you may have questions, you may have worries. This is a table for you. Jesus made it obvious that this was for everyone. It is a place where we meet Christ, not where we have all the answers. So everyone is welcome at this table. You don't need to be a member of this church or any church. You are welcome. We also have gluten-free elements available for those of you who have need. We want you to come to this table. Bring your fear. Bring your doubt. Bring them to Christ. You may come. Would the servers please come forward?